Galatians chapter 1, verses 6 to 10. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preach to you, let him be eternally condemned. As we have already said, so now I say again, if anybody is preaching to you a gospel other than what you accepted, let him be eternally condemned. Am I now trying to win the approval of men or of God? Or am I trying to please men? If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a servant of Christ.
Well, good evening, everyone. Nice to see so many people here. Our first nice day of August, isn't it, today, I think? Shall we pray before we start? Father, thank you so much that you are a speaking God, that you have used words that communicate to us, to tell us about yourself, so that we can love you as you wish, that we can understand the plans that you have for your creation and for us and for those that you love. Lord, may we hear your voice this evening, and may we hear it clearly. May you impress upon us what it is that we are to do with this, that we may be obedient people living for you and doing your work in this great privilege that you have given us to be part of your story. Amen. Don't move from the gospel. Did you know of every 10 people who commit themselves to Jesus, after just 12 months have passed, only one of them is likely to be an active, praying, Bible-reading Christian? The other 9 will have given up. So said a statistic I read a couple of years back. But we shouldn't be shocked. After all, it's how people's enthusiasms often work out, isn't it? Of the number of people who perhaps join a gym today, how many will be pumping iron in just 1 month's time? Well, in the parable of the sower in the New Testament, Jesus tells us that of 2/3 of converts, by which I mean those who accept rather than immediately rejecting Jesus, will fall away quickly from an active saving faith. And Paul wrote his letters to the Galatians, widely considered to be the very first of the New Testament documents and therefore closest in time to the events of Jesus' life and ministry, because of this very issue, the problem of people moving away and turning their heads from the gospel, from Christ, by which we mean who Jesus is, what he did, and what he taught, and staying committed to that apostolic agenda. Why does this moving away happen, and what can we do to prevent it? And this is a very real issue for all churches. Well, in terms of the parable, this letter, I believe, is focused very much on that precious third of converts who in the terms of the parable become established in good soil, solid, church-going Christians. Now imagine for a minute you've been given a genuine master-crafted wristwatch made in platinum and adorned with diamonds, precise to the millisecond, year in, year out. Would you then deliberately swap it with someone who comes along offering you a £25 fake imitation, which doesn't keep time, chews batteries, and is going to let you down when you most need it? It's stupid, isn't it? However persuasive the person who swapped it with you was. But this is exactly what the church-going believers are doing with the authentic apostolic gospel, which focuses on Jesus. They're deliberately replacing it with fake, quote, gospels based on religious ritual. And that's why Paul starts not with his customary prayer of thanksgiving for the Galatian believers, but with a telling off. In Greek letters, if you expressed astonishment, you were delivering a strong rebuke. That's what was meant. This is not, Paul believes, an unconscious drifting away, but something far more serious. And because they're fake, these other gospels are not gifts of God's grace that we looked at last week. They're something else. And they're powerless to do the saving work of Jesus for us. I mean, Paul's readers were probably astonished themselves, weren't they? Because Paul, in effect, is saying, in throwing out the genuine gospel, they're actually deserting Jesus himself and putting their faith in something else. It's quite a charge. Well, I have three headings to help us pick our way through these verses before we draw some applications. Firstly, the enemy's Trojan horse. And there we'll look at why this falling away is happening at all. Secondly, do look a gift horse in the mouth. And there we'll look at whose responsibility it is to protect us from falling away. And finally, beware the horse's kick. And there we'll look at the cost of failure. So firstly, the enemy's Trojan horse. You'll have noticed that the Bible is full of military imagery, and we are foot soldiers engaged in a spiritual war. A good example would be in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, where Paul says, we do not wage war as the world does, but then goes on to say how we do wage wars. Well, we know that God is going to win this war. But there is a question mark over where each of us will be when victory is declared by King Jesus. And in the meantime, the arch-pretender Satan is a very sly and shrewd opponent, isn't he? Right from the off, his military tactics have been to corrupt God's people in two ways. Firstly, by full frontal assault, external persecution, could be temptations, money worries, relationships, that sort of thing. Secondly, by careful use of infiltration and propaganda inside the church. And it's this second, far more deadly tactic that Paul is writing about here. Now, some of you will have seen the film Troy, starring Brad Pitt, I think, which is based on the Greek-Trojan wars over the alluring Helen, wife of Menelaus. And the Greeks try the full frontal assault, but the walls of Troy are for much too strong a defense. So eventually they come up with this rather clever ruse. They try the second tactic of infiltration, of attack from inside the defended city itself, which involves appealing to the defenders' vanity and stupidity, not to forget some large-scale carpentry. Now, even if Satan's woodworking skills were not to stretch as far as even an IKEA flat pack assembly, he uses this same insurgency approach against Fortress Church, even today, by getting his agents inside our fellowships. He attacks with his own version of the Trojan horse, something with the look of religious reverence, which is so appealing, it's warmly welcomed inside. And of course, in computing, you'll know this term. Some viruses are described as Trojans because of the way they work. Like the mythical wooden horse, they look pretty appealing, but they're ultimately very destructive. And false teaching inside a church is just like a Trojan virus in your computer. Let's look at a more modern military example, shall we? We've seen the insurgents in Afghanistan and Iraq. They tell people that they can give them something better than the governments there. They stir up discontent amongst the people against the authorities, disrupting society by attacking law and order forces and blowing up public amenities, taking away people's sense of security, of liberty and enjoyment of life. Same sort of idea. And the agents who pour from the belly of the Trojan horse inside the church are what Paul calls the false brothers, the insurgents and spies of chapter 2, verse 4. He uses that same word of insurgency. And that's who Paul's referring to here in verse 6 of chapter 1 when he talks about some people. Well, these few some people have come to occupy central influence in the affairs of the church. But the very way Paul describes them vividly describes the secrecy and stealth with which their poisonous influence takes hold and strangles the breath out of the believers. How do these people get into the church, you ask? Well, the false brothers are often such very pleasant people, and they're so competent and seemingly clever and sensible. And because of that, it's us who place them into central leadership positions. And their teaching looks and sounds so attractive and appeals so much, like Eve in the Garden of Eden, hearing what Satan had to say about the fruit on the forbidden tree, that we end up welcoming it, just like Eve did. And we open the lectern up to them with open arms. What kind of weapons are they using? Well, they say the pen is mightier than the sword, and in a church this is certainly true, because our job is to proclaim God's written word and Jesus, the living word, to those outside the church and teach it to ourselves inside. And these false brothers are using words to attack with, and it's not such a strange idea. In Ephesians, when Paul describes the armour of God, he likens the effect of words to a sword when he talks about the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. As Pink Floyd said in the title track of their most famous album, it's a battle of words that we humans are caught up in. I thought I'd put that one in for you, Kenman. That's all. So what are these false brothers saying? In what way are these teachers false? Well, in verse 7, they're using the words to throw people into confusion, literally, deliberately agitate or stir up trouble. And they're using the words to distort or pervert the genuine gospel. They're promoting what Paul describes in 6 as a different gospel. We discover later in the letter what that means, changing the emphasis by adding Old Testament legalistic practices. And this religiosity is sold to church people as being more effective than the original apostles' teaching. Well, that was a nice start, they might say. But it needs to grow up now and reflect modern times. I mean, we've all heard people talk like this, haven't we? You know, we need the church to and Christianity to keep in tune with the 21st century and modern scientific thinking. You know, things have moved on. Well, Paul is very quick to point out that sort of talk is a sleight of hand. There is only one gospel. One Jesus, one way of salvation. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me, says Jesus in John chapter 14. And to reject the apostolic gospel is to reject Jesus. Only this one gospel has the authority and power of God the Father, and only this one gospel is able to deal with our sin. It doesn't need to evolve or grow up. God got it right the first time. And it is God's gospel, isn't it? Which God has chosen to reveal through Jesus and the apostles like Paul. Make any deviation from what the apostles taught and it becomes not God's gospel but man's gospel. Powerless to overcome sin, powerless to save. All such different gospel can do, all it can do is condemn us. And that's why Paul rebukes them, why he's so astonished. The Galatians are effectively condemning themselves, and so soon after becoming believers. So beware the enemy's Trojan horse. Secondly, do look a gift horse in the mouth before opening the gate. So who's ultimately responsible, do you think, for the believer being thrown off track? The infiltrator? The bad teacher? Well, in our liberal Western world, way of thinking, complete with its highly developed blame culture, where it's always someone else's fault, that's exactly what we're going to say, isn't it? But you'd be disagreeing with the Bible. In these verses, Paul puts the blame squarely on the shoulders of the believers themselves. In verse 6, Paul says to his readers, "You are deserting. You are turning." He doesn't say, "You are being turned." It's us, you see, who are guilty of allowing ourselves to become corrupted. I mean, we might attract some sympathy over having ended up with bad bishops, pastors, preachers, or home leaders who don't teach the Bible correctly, but before God, it's our responsibility to guard and police our churches, its people, and our own faith. So think carefully. Do your homework and study what's being offered without relying on the sales blurb. Don't welcome a Trojan horse into your Christian life. Thirdly, beware the horse's kick. James, in his letter, tells Bible readers how they will face a more severe judgment by God than other Christians. And Jesus speaks of the terrible consequence of anyone, especially church people, who lead others away from trusting solely in the person of Jesus, who make Christianity a do religion rather than a done act of faith. And in verses 8 and 9 here, Paul tells us what their fate will be: eternal condemnation. Well, what Paul doesn't say here, but is implied, is that if we listen to such a teacher and exchange the apostles' teaching for this do religiosity, trusting that instead to earn our stairway to heaven, another bit for you, then we actually lose Jesus and we lose heaven. Where we stand on Jesus' done gospel determines our fate at judgment day. This is not some academic dispute over a relatively trivial point of theology. It's absolutely crucial because it has life and death consequences for me and for you. And as if the language of verse 8 were not strong enough already to make the point, Paul repeats it with his sledgehammer once again to ensure we don't miss the serious of it. To miss the seriousness of it. And it's almost word for word in verse 9. The cost of teaching and or switching to this religiosity is personal, eternal condemnation. So don't stand behind the false teacher, like the untrustworthy horse or Trojan horse in the public square. He's going to give you a very painful kick where it hurts the most. Rather, stand four square behind Jesus and the gospel as proclaimed by Jesus' appointed apostles. Right, well, let's see if we can draw some applications from this. And firstly, I want to say, do your homework. It might just save your life. Each of us, as we've seen, is responsible for learning the Bible well enough for ourselves to spot wrong teaching. We need to listen to teachers in the pulpit, at home groups, and in the lecture hall with a critical ear and open Bibles. Are they explaining the passage in front of us, what God is actually saying, or are they in effect telling us what they would like the text to mean, or going off page into lectures on social or political issues? I mean, an example would be a sermon I once heard when the preacher was speaking on one of the fruits of the Spirit from chapter 5 of Galatians. Now, instead of explaining what the Bible said the particular word meant, he started by telling us what his dictionary said the word meant. and then launched into a speech on his view of the word. He's not put it, you know, it's completely off page. It's not the passage. Forget it. Are they putting the passage in context? Now, if you say someone spends most of their time cutting people up with sharp knives, you might conclude that they're very likely a sadist and murderer, unless you're told that they're a surgeon who does the cutting up in an operating theatre. So actually, they're saving lives. Well, Bible teaching taking out of context can easily become murder, can't it? A murder weapon instead of a means of saving lives if it's taken out of context. Because you can always switch the meaning of something out of context. So two tests you can use. And the next time you hear something doctrinally dodgy, will you spot it? And if you do, what are you going to do about it? I'll leave that one for you. You discussed that a little in the questions. But do your homework and be critical. Secondly, learn to recognize the footprint of false teaching. In short, it's teaching that denies or plays down who Jesus is, what he said, and what he did as described by the apostles. I know I keep coming back to that point. It's very, very important. It denies the facts or plays down the significance of Jesus' birth, his death and resurrection and the miracles. It denies that everyone's greatest problem is sin and suggests there's no real afterlife. It insists on additional rules like a second blessing or speaking in tongues. It might insist that the teaching of its leaders is just as valid as that of the apostles, like the Mormons or Roman Catholics do. It changes the emphasis on Jesus' teaching, especially John chapter 6, by trying to bring heaven down to earth. It insists that the gospel is actually about feeding and clothing people, especially the world's poor and dispossessed, giving them justice and political democracy here and now in this life. Well, yes, that's important, and Jesus talks on these things, and we should be about that. But it's not the primary goal of the gospel. The primary goal of the gospel is empty souls, hearts, not empty bellies. But the American Episcopal Church say it's about empty bellies. And large swathes of the Church of England say that. But Jesus says, you've come and followed me again because you've got empty bellies again after he'd fed the 6,000 the day before. But I'm interested in empty souls. That's what he was interested in. You see, in reality, that is Jesus' agenda. That's where the focus is. Are you saved in right relationship with God? Ready for the next life, ready to meet your maker. All right, let's just say, what is false teaching not? Because, you know, I don't want people to be confused here. It's not a preacher's views on secondary issues, like recent or ancient creationism, on whether there should be women clergy or not, or whether there'll be a millennial rule of Jesus on earth. These issues are neither here nor there in the final analysis. If the Bible needed to be crystal clear on them, it would be. People get very worked up about these issues, and I've seen plenty of folks actually leave churches in a real huff because of them. But they're not false teaching. Deep-thinking Christians come to different conclusions on some of these secondary issues. But we still work with them and love them for the sake of the primary issues. All right, thirdly, actively protect and promote apostolic teaching in our church. It's very tempting for me to say, of course, that Christ Church is one of a handful of wonderful churches with consistent, spot-on teaching that never gets anything wrong. But go out and about to other churches, and boy, will you find plenty of wooden horses in the shape of evil false teachers there. It's surprising how rude we can be sometimes about other churches which are successfully winning people for Christ and keeping them walking in their faith. But we need to keep looking at home. Every fellowship, including us, however well-meaning and careful to avoid pitfalls, is always at risk of developing bad habits and can add or detract from the one true gospel. Remember Jesus' teaching about specks and planks in the eye. There's no room for self-congratulation, for pride and complacency on these issues. We are our brother's keepers. And it's not just ourselves we need to keep an eye on. It's as much up to us as the leadership here to keep our own teachers prayed for, encouraged and on the straight and narrow biblical path. It may mean having to make the odd occasional gentle challenge, best done by putting our point as a question, but it's vital to avoid this Galatian problem. Satan will work very hard to bring this teaching into Christchurch, so we've got to work doubly hard to keep it out. And we have to make this apostolic-based proclamation and teaching of the church our number one priority, don't we? Let nothing else get in the way of that, whatever the cost. Like any church, we've seen a number of people getting huffy with others and unsettling the church with sideshows instead of humbly pulling their own weight in the gospel work. So next time someone here upsets you, what are you going to do about it? Blow a fuse and walk out? Or forgive and get on with the mission that God gave you here? It is up to you and to me to forgivingly bear with one another and to gently encourage and lovingly lead each other back to the biblical, apostolic gospel and the work that involves, the work we share to live as united workers, albeit imperfect, centered on Jesus and him crucified. Well, I'm ending with that phrase from 2 Corinthians, Jesus and him crucified, because it's the pithy soundbite that Paul uses to explain the genuine apostolic gospel. It centers on the divinity of Jesus, he really is God, on the reason he had to die on the cross to deal with our sin, and on the consequences of the cross, the way made for humanity to avoid disaster and be saved for heaven, to become at last truly human. So let's not move from this gospel. Let's not exchange it for some fake imitation. But let's make sure we keep the main thing, the main thing.